Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast.
Where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yeah, reality. If you can't handle reality, it's now your own problem. Because the improbability is now 1-to-1.
I have my towel. I'm not worried.
Oh, good. I forgot my towel. Oh, my gosh. I am not a frude.
I'm so sorry.
This is episode number 158, and we're going to talk about Douglas Adams' A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is the first novel in his 5-volume trilogy.
Yes.
Yeah, and I picked this. This is light. This is fun. This is comedy. But it's British comedy, which I normally find rich. I really like British comedy. There's always a lot of thought behind it that we don't always find in American comedy. I fell in love with this series. It was on the radio first. Did you enjoy it?
Coming out, which tells you a lot right there.
Oh, that's great.
About my age.
This book was everywhere at high school. Everybody that was a reader was reading this in high school. I just have a clear memory.
Yeah, this was
1980. 1979, okay. I think. Maybe 1980.
Maybe in this country for the volume I have, 1980.
Right. Just a quick history, because I think the history of this is interesting, because being an audio guy, this was originally a radio series. Before the novel, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was a radio series, and there was two series that were 6 episodes each, and the episodes were called Fits, right? So episode 1 is Fit the First, and then Fit the Second. So 2 6-episode series, and then Douglas Adams novelized them into these novels. So out of those 6 episodes, he wrote The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, The Restaurant at the End of the Universe, and Life, the Universe, and Everything. And then he wrote So Long and Thanks for All the Fish.
Yes.
And Mostly Harmless. And then, unfortunately, he passed away, which he was very young. So that was really sad.
Well, he also wrote Dirk Gently's
He did write other things. I was just talking about The Hitchhiker's Guide.
Oh, got it. Sorry.
That's okay. And then after he passed away, Dirk Maggs, who is just absolutely the best audio dramatist there is.
He's great.
Yeah. He did a audio drama of So Long and Thanks for All the Fish and Mostly Harmless. So he brought it all back. You know, he finished it up.
Mm-hmm.
So really, really fantastic.
Well, and you know, it's interesting you saying that this began as an audio drama or a radio show, whatever, because I was looking over his biography briefly on Wikipedia and realized I didn't know he had written for Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. For me, that was a huge explanation to all this humor.
Oh, okay, good.
Which I've always loved.
Yeah,
but I also really loved Monty Python's Flying Circus. So I was like, oh, I get it. He was already always thinking this way.
Right. Yeah. He was in that crowd for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he was a bit younger than those guys.
Mm-hmm.
But not too much. But yeah, he was definitely one of them.
Yeah. The same kind of crazy.
Exactly. Exactly. And what a cool idea it was. You know, this is just one of those, It's you know, there's been copies since, right? People that have tried to emulate it, but this is one of those unique ideas that I just can't help but appreciate how it's put together and everything. So when he wrote it, I mean, it was brand new,
you know. Oh, yeah.
Obviously, and there was just nothing like it. There just wasn't anything like it. And even the audio drama, I listened to part of it again, the original, and it stands up absolutely completely. It doesn't sound to me like it was made in the 70s at all.
Oh, really?
Not at all. And it's just tremendous. really tremendous.
The book doesn't read that way either. I mean, mm-hmm. other than the fact that I guess now you'd have to stick in smartphones or something. But the thing is, yeah. is, and we could talk about this, he was very prescient
yeah.
in a lot of the crazy, at the time, science fiction things he put on ships and things, the inventions. And I was going to say, the other thing is he was so influential. Because you look at all the people that came out of his influence, like, and the two that matter to me most are Terry Pratchett, who I just love his writing, and Neil Gaiman, who took it and kind of went off in a different direction, but still shows signs of that kind of absurdist way of looking at things. They yeah. take things and stand them on their heads, so you just look at them a whole new way.
Well, I love that you brought those two up, because, yeah, that was the other crowd he was in, right?
Is right.
these writerly crowd. Now, Neil Gaiman, one of the first things that he did as a writer was a biography of Douglas Adams.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so it was just one of the early things he did right as he was getting started.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure he was writing for comics at the time he wrote that biography.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he was doing Sandman. And Terry Pratchett, I'm not sure what the connection is there, but I love Terry Pratchett and have not read near enough of him.
Well, I just feel like there may have been a personal connection, but I just feel like Terry Pratchett took Douglas Adams' influence and deepened it as a storytelling style. Because what he does is, well, we read Hogfather. And so what he does is he takes all the myths and stories that people tell and then kind of looks underneath for another layer or two, while on the surface all these wild things are going on and all these crazy connections are being made that are just laugh out loud funny. And what he adds that to me, Adams, you know, didn't have, because Adams has a more pure form of this kind of absurdist comic style, is he's looking for deeper, deeper meaning. I feel like Adams isn't, you know, going two or three levels deep, like as we found in Hogfather.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and it's funny because I have to thank you for choosing this. For one thing, I hadn't read it in so long, and it's still so funny.
Oh, good.
And yeah. then also what it made me do is pick up some of my favorite Terry Pratchett's. And then I said, you know what? Within his, like, 45 books or whatever he wrote, he has various series of characters. And I said, I've read some of the series of characters, but I've never read them all straight through from the beginning. So that's what I'm doing now.
Oh, good. Good.
So it's kind of fun.
Yeah. As I'm sitting here looking at this, I realized that I made an error earlier.
Mm.
Life, the Universe, and Everything was written after the series as well.
So, oh, okay.
So the first two books are the first two series.
Got
and
it.
Then in like 2005 or something like that is when they did Life, the Universe, and Everything, So Long, Thanks for All the Fish, and Mostly Harmless.
Okay.
So there were three additional series made in the 2000s. So apologize for that error, but I think that that's cool to note, because I just love how they wrapped it back around and brought it back to where it came from. In fact, they mm-hmm. even Dirk Maggs and crew even toured that performance of, I don't know exactly what was included, but it was a live audio drama version of Hitchhiker's Guide. In some incarnation, they toured at least through England. I don't know if they ever came to the United States. If they had, I would have done everything I could to have been there.
That would have been fun.
Yeah, it would have been great.
Well, and the TV show, I remember watching that. Where did you say where that came in the?
That would have come
after the
quite
books?
A bit after. Let's see, 1981. Actually, it's not quite a bit after.
No, it's fairly concurrent because.
Yeah.
My husband, and so I must not have read it right when it came out, because I had met my husband not too long after that. I can't remember now. No, it must have been a couple of years, so 83. So that's when he went, you haven't seen this? Oh my gosh, you've got to watch this. And we watched it and just laughed our butts off.
Nice.
And he was like, and yeah. here's the book. So then we read the book. And then we read the other books that, you know, had come after that were out at that point. So,
yeah, my understanding is you mentioned Dirk Gently. I think the BBC is doing Dirk Gently as a TV show now. And the guy who played Frodo, I forget his name, is the sidekick. He's not Gently. He's the sidekick.
Yeah. Okay.
Can't remember. Elijah Wood. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so okay. Elijah Wood was is the sidekick. Anyway, so it'd like be worth watching.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, no. I was just going to say I'd like to give it a watch.
Yeah. Yeah, I would too. And I've tried reading those books and then I think two or three times. Mm-hmm. And each time I've gone, I think I'd rather hear it
yeah.
than read it.
And BBC does have audio drama of both of those.
Okay.
And they're really good, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah, the long, gentle, or the long, what is it?
The long, dark tea time of the soul, which is a line that I think is in this novel.
It is.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's where it came from, because that was such a great line. I mean, he has such a way with words.
That's for sure.
So we've talked about his history.
but we have one more thing to talk about before we move on. Because possibly the greatest incarnation of this, and I know that you've mentioned it, which is why I'm excited to mention it, is the computer game. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Infocom text-based game, which he had a hand in, meaning he co-wrote it. So this is for those of you who, you know, maybe you'll remember and smile, or if you don't even know, you these types of games, you would just type. It would say you are in a room. And you don't feel well, and you're laying on a bed, and then you just type in, get up, and it'd say, you attempt to get up, but you fall back to the bed.
Right.
And then you have to figure out how to reach in your pocket of your robe and get aspirin because you're hungover and all,
Yeah, you'd say, look around, and it would say, you see a nightstand, a bathrobe, a chair, or whatever. Yeah. You see something yellow out the window.
Right. And it was only about... I don't know, maybe 5 years ago that I dug through the internet and I found it in a version that you could run on a current PC.
What?
So it exists out there.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Because, let me just say, Infocom games were the greatest. And I'm really appalled by the fact that so few people now know about Zork.
Zork, yeah.
But it was their first game.
I love it.
And it was, I can remember sitting there at the computer, drawing out the mazes, because they describe it and you're having to draw the little map. So it was the truest form of, Dungeons and Dragons you could do on the computer at that time, which I didn't know anything about at Dungeons and Dragons. But here I was, newly married wife, and my husband's glad to, look what the computer can do. And it was kind of that way. There wasn't really an internet and all that kind of stuff. So you buy these and load the disks on and change the disks out, the big, huge disks.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
And so I played all those games right up to the bitter end. And that one, the Douglas Adams game, you had to really know the book. I reread the book in order to do it because so much of the stuff didn't make sense. And I still remember the gyrations you had to go through to get the babblefish into your ear were insane. I mean, nuts. It goes down the drain. It bounces off your head and goes down the drain. Move the box. You can't move the box. Move the box over the drain. Shove the box. Okay, you can shove the box, but the fish slithers down underneath.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, it was fantastic.
Towel over the drain. Okay. The fish stops. You pick it up again.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It was just...
Love it. It was just wonderful. Wonderful. Yes. In fact, after this podcast, maybe I'll track it down again. If I do, I'll let you know.
Okay, definitely.
Because why not?
Yes. Definitely, that's one you had to have the cheat guide for because you're never going to get through it.
That's good stuff. I love it. Well, shoot, should we summarize this plot? Is it summarizable?
Well, I think, there's Arthur Dent.
Yep, Arthur Dent.
His house, he wakes up and he remembers the reason he'd gone on a bender the night before and he's so hungover is that he'd found out his house was going to be destroyed for a bypass.
Yep.
And his friend Ford Prefect comes along and says, No, you have to come with me down to the pub. And they get beamed up to us. They hitch a ride on a passing spaceship because Ford Prefect is dying to get off the planet and he knows Earth is going to be demolished for a galactic bypass. So there are a lot of echoes of, is that meta?
Yeah.
Where it's referring to itself a lot.
Right. Yeah.
And so then they start hitching through space, and because they wind up being caught on a ship, picked up by another ship that has the improbability drive going. Everything improbable starts really happening.
That was just a brilliant idea right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, when they're floating in space and Trillian and Zaphod Beeblebrox.
Beeblebrox.
Oh my gosh. Beeblebrox. Whatever. Zaphod picks them up.
Yep, exactly. And then they sort of join that adventure. So Zaphod Beeblebrox is the president of the galaxy.
Yes.
And he has stolen this ship and they're flying around. So at that point, you know, the plot is basically them going, joining what Zaphod's after, right?
Right.
And then
what is Zaphod after?
He's after,
right?
You're like, well, what is he after? Yeah, it's
attention.
Attention. Maybe? Yes. Thank you very much. Because no, I'm thinking, you know, there is no real object, but they end up going. Looking for Magrathea, which is a legendary planet.
Yeah.
And he ends up finding it.
Yeah, because one of the things I like is that his job is to be outrageous and draw all attention to him.
That's exactly right.
In fact, because the president never does anything important, but everybody pays attention to him. That means everybody behind the scenes can get on with their work. And I thought,
isn't that prescient? Oh my gosh. Yeah. And that's what I thought too.
Give it to Donald Trump.
Yeah. And in this book, there's a line that says anybody who can make themselves president ought not be allowed to do so.
Right.
And I was just like, oh, how perfect is that?
Yes.
It's just good. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So that's generally the plot, but really the plot is not the thing here. The thing are his asides, you know, where he's, you know, it's the same thing in the radio show. Where, you know, this plot is going on, but as it's going on, there are these brilliant things that he just does on the side, and then he'll get back to the story. But Pratchett does that a little bit, doesn't he?
Oh, a lot.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, it's kind of it's cool. It's just great, but that's where, all of the good stuff happens. In my opinion.
Yeah, because he's making comments about everything else that's going on. People's attitudes, just even in when he's commenting on the places you're going by or the Hitchhiker's Guide itself, which, okay, ebooks way early and, or ebooks. Yeah. That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah. Yeah.
And audiobooks and everything. It's all stuff that applies to our lives right now. So it's also a satirical commentary and
agreed.
Absurdist at the same time.
Yeah. Very absurd. Very absurd. So, yeah, well, let's throw spoilers to the wind.
Oh, I'm sorry. I guess I already did.
No. We want to do that just to make sure if you guys want to listen to it. You know, because there's a lot of jokes to talk about here. but yeah, it's fantastic. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend you read it. But let's talk about some of this.
Okay.
Yeah. So, He does this humor. There's humor that's just down to earth humor, you know, everyday humor, like, you know, dealing with bureaucracy and things, like when Arthur is having an argument with the guy who's going to knock his house down.
Yes.
And he says, well, you know, the plans were in the display department, which was, you know, downstairs in a closet, which was guarded by a leopard or something like that. And you had to go in there and get the file cabinet unlocked. That was the display department.
Yes.
And, you know, that just makes me laugh because it seems like, you know, we have in our lives this government bureaucracy that tries to make things really hard for everybody. you know, we want it to be helpful, but it's not. And, anyway, I laughed out loud at that because of experiences that I've had.
Yeah. He's like, but Mr. Dent, the plants have been available in the local planning office for the last 9 months. Oh, yes. Well, as soon as I heard, I went straight around to see them yesterday afternoon. And I'm thinking, yeah, no sending out a letter.
Yep.
No giving a notice. We put the plans on display. And of course, then the funny thing is that what happens next is you find out when no complaining about the earth getting destroyed, the plans have been on display in your local planning office.
For heaven's sakes, mankind, if you can't make it to Alpha Centauri, I don't have any feelings, any sympathy, right, for you.
Right. Exactly.
Yep. That's good stuff.
Well, and it's also that thing of at the same time that it's good stuff and it's hilarious, it's at the same time kind of poking us, because how often do we do that to someone and then turn around and get indignant over something that's kind of just maybe elevated or a similar circumstance that's happening to us that we were just telling somebody to, oh, just shut up and, you know, be tough.
Right.
About.
That's a good point. Yeah.
He does that all the time. This is absurdist in so many ways and just fun, but he's also making a lot of points about things.
I agree. And a lot of what he pokes fun at, in my opinion, is philosophy. Philosophy, and you could include religion in philosophy, right?
Yeah, I'd almost flip that. I'd say he's making fun of religion.
Religion, okay.
And philosophy.
Philosophy, yeah, because, yeah.
He did call himself a radical atheist, and that doesn't really matter for when you're reading the book. But he said radical because I think it was radical. He said, because I don't want anybody to make a mistake and think they can talk me out of it. It's never happening.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he does address religion sometimes. Gosh, at the very opening is the first hit, right? Mm-hmm. Where he, in fact, that would be interesting to talk about. Let me get that spot where...
Is this the one Thursday?
Yeah, yep.
It says, and then one Thursday, nearly 2,000 years after one man had been nailed to a tree for saying how great it would be to be nice to people for a change, a girl sitting on her own in a small cafe in Rixmanworth suddenly realized what it was that had been going wrong all this time, and she finally knew how the world could be made a good and happy place. This time it was right. It would work, and no one would have to get nailed to anything. Sadly, however, before she could get to a phone to tell anyone about it, a terrible, stupid catastrophe occurred and the idea was lost forever. But this is not her story. This is not her story. But it is the story of that terrible, stupid catastrophe and some of its consequences. And I read this, and it was at this point that I had a sudden reorientation to the way I'd always thought of this book. Okay, and don't take this wrong, because I really like this book. It's really funny. This won't be the last time I read it, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
But it occurred to me that Douglas Adams kind of had a mean sense of humor.
Hmm.
He was kind of mad, and he was kind of taking it out by being funny about it.
Hmm. Do you feel that way about the rest of the book from that point on?
There are parts of... No, not the entire book.
Okay.
Because I went on reading, but there are parts of the book where it did make me notice things more that I wouldn't have noticed before. Now I'm trying to think, like when they're discovering, how do you say the planet's name?
Magrathea. Mm-hmm.
And let's see if I can find it. It says, as Ford gazed at this, it's when they're finding a planet, I think, or looking at something amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. As Ford gazed at the spectacle of light before them, excitement burned inside him, but only the excitement of seeing a strange new planet. It was enough for him to see it as it was. It faintly irritated him that Zaphod had to impose some ludicrous fantasy onto the scene to make it work for him. All this Magrathea nonsense seemed juvenile. Isn't it enough to see that a garden is beautiful without having to believe that there are fairies at the bottom of it, too?
Hmm.
And he says a lot of things that are kind of similar to that. Like, there's a point where he says, I'd rather be happy than right any day. And are you? No. That's where it all falls down, of course.
Yeah.
You know, and so he's continually making the point that believing in anything other than what you see right now, or then the facts as they are, doesn't matter. It's kind of silly. It doesn't make you happier. It's just adding on stuff that's not real. And why would you do that? And so I started noticing he does that. He points that kind of stuff out a lot. It's hilarious. It's mm-hmm. in context.
Yeah, yeah. And, it, you but, know, he yeah. is an atheist, like you said. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I felt, you know, that opening line there where he said, shoot, I should have opened it in front of me. But you said that he...
one Thursday.
Or yeah, well, yeah, that's the one Thursday one. Let's see. Is that in the very, very beginning?
Yeah, it is. It's the, like, fourth paragraph.
Okay, I find it. Yeah.
Fifth paragraph.
He says, nearly 2,000 years after one man had been nailed to a tree for saying how great it would be to be nice to people for a change. That's not a bad one sentence sort of summary of the message of Christ, right? You know, when Christ
it's
was
terrible.
Asked. Well, no, I don't think it is, because when Christ was asked, you know, what are the most important commandments? It was basically love God and love each other, right? So this is one aspect of what Jesus was saying, is we need to be nice to each other, right? And we're not being nice to each other now, you know, so, but I'm just saying, you know, why isn't that sort of an agreement of what Christ's message is, at least that part of it? Isn't he saying there, that's a good message, right?
Well, the bad maybe part I know is, too much about it, because yeah. I read that and went, that is the most utter nicification of
sure,
the whole
yeah.
thing, because
you can't possibly summarize it in one sentence.
Well, no, the reason he's crucified is yeah. because the religious people at the time didn't like that he was claiming to be God.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he was crucified. It wasn't right. because he said people should be nice to each other. That was never the reason. So,
yeah,
but that
so he,
is the
yeah,
nicification
so didn't
of what everybody sees
they
as.
They didn't do it because he said that. Okay, I get you.
Yeah, sorry. Maybe I'm being too literal.
No.
But that's what he's saying. But see, that's when I looked at that whole thing and went, he doesn't like people very much, does he? He thinks they're all stupid, and he thinks they're kind of mean to each other, and he's kind of pointed about how he's getting that point across. Mm-hmm. I think that's why I thought, oh, he's kind of mean, huh? Because he doesn't like, to me, I felt like he was saying people are stupid. And I felt like a lot of those other points he was saying people are stupid. Like the thing about the fairies at the bottom of the garden.
I mean, that's a direct swipe at religion, you know, at religious people where you're
And Arthur Conan Doyle, he's connecting Arthur Conan Doyle's belief in fairies, which there were pictures at the bottom of a garden mm-hmm. that somebody faked of fairies that Conan Doyle went around showing everybody to religion. He's lumping it all together as anything you believe in like that.
Right.
It's ridiculous. Right. And so anyway.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And yeah, he does do that. He does do that throughout. And there's other places too where he's talking about the philosophy of it.
So, anyway, we're way off your point.
No, this is all good. So, but no, I agree. I agree with what you're saying there, but I do agree. I do also think that he makes fun of philosophy as well.
Oh yeah.
General philosophy, which is also, you know, human driven, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's run by humans, especially at the end with the computer and those two philosophers. Yeah, we demand rigidly defined areas of doubt and uncertainty. You know, I thought that was funny, too. So.
Yeah, he's really just saying that life and the universe are absurd, and to try to understand them and put meaning into them in the way that philosophy and or religion do is pointless.
I think that what he's saying
in a hilarious way.
Yeah, in a hilarious way he's saying that. But he may also be saying, you know, that for humanity to think that we can understand everything is also absurd.
Yeah.
Which that's something that I agree with.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we, you know, that is, you know, a long time ago, gosh, teenager or something, is when I first had the thought that we're making all these conclusions based, you know, about the universe based, you know, partially on, you know, observation. And we're here in our little piece of the galaxy, and we're looking out and we're making conclusions based on what we see, But the one thing that I feel like that I do really know for sure is that when we get out there, it's going to be different than we think. Right. And the reason that I think that is because everything has been that way. You know, every time, you know, from what's over on the other side of the ocean to, you know, even closer things, what's at the bottom of the lake, you know, this trip that humanity has taken of exploration always reveals surprises. And so whenever I hear a physicist, and Stephen Hawking was one of them, say, mm-hmm. I think we're at the end of physics, I just don't understand that at all. It just blows me away completely when I hear someone say that.
Because I have to agree.
How can that be possible? You know, it's like, okay, he's basically saying everything that we can figure out from here we've done is, you know, that's the, you know, I don't even know if I believe that, but it seems to me that that's the most that anyone could ever say about being finished.
And you're right. That is one of the things that Douglas Adams is poking fun at, because it's that's kind of the point of the improbability engine or whatever.
Yeah, that's good
because
stuff.
All these, well, the odds on that are, you know, 1,000,000 to 1 or whatever. Well, and here we are. You're the guy who took the girl away that I was trying to pick up at the party. What are the odds that we'd meet like this, picked up in space as we were shoved out of the Vorgon airlock or whatever?
That was good stuff. Yeah, so they shoved out of the Vorgon. They were in space.
Vorgon,
and then, I forget what it was, you know, 2 to the 2,000,000th or something to 1. And, boy, there's a whole bunch of improbability that we haven't figured out yet. And, he ends up knowing, Ford knows Zaphod and Arthur knows Trillion.
Right.
Yeah. And it's just amazing. And I think that pokes fun at fiction, too, because, you know, how often have we had some coincidence in fiction just make us roll our eyes and say, oh, my gosh. But then the way I'm sure that he was thinking, you know, this is going to be too big a coincidence. How on earth could I do? Oh, hey, how about this? You know?
Yeah. And because the improbability.
Right.
Engine.
And now he can do whatever he wants and it's going to be plausible because he's got this improbability drive that can allow him to make improbable things happen.
Yeah.
And now his fiction does not have to make sense. Right.
Yeah.
Which is the constraint of fiction writers everywhere.
And yet, even within that, he's still spinning stories about how to explain things.
Right, right.
Which is what was really funny to me about, is it Slardy Bartfast?
Uh-huh.
Is that his name?
Slardy Bartfast.
The guy who his specialty is fjords. Here's what this award is worth, you know?
Making planets. Luxury planets.
Exactly. And this was the Earth was a special ordered computer.
Yeah.
For a race that looks like mice when their tentacles or whatever are in our part of the universe. They were running experiments on us because it was to see what's the answer to life, the universe, and everything.
Oh, love it.
Yeah, and so then he veers off, when you get to the answer, he veers off into the absurdity again, but he's still pointing out all the silly reasons there could be for doing things. All the things we haven't thought of, like you're saying. That mice, that the Earth is a giant computer and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Which I loved.
Yeah.
What a cool thought. We're all running around just executing a program.
Yep.
And the reason that we're doing it is to get the meaning of life. And the meaning of life is not what we think it is. The answer. Got to be careful how we ask questions.
That's the thing. And even the
Seven and a half millions later. Yeah,
the beings who ask the question aren't aware of what they're asking.
Right.
Like, but what does that mean? What does that question mean? And they're like, well, of course. Wait, I don't know.
And I do really love that too. You know, you have science fiction writers, you know, Arthur C. Clarke, another Brit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another British atheist, science-oriented guy. And then he writes his fiction. And yet, you know, in things like Childhood's End and 2001... there is no God in those stories, right? But there is a replacement. It's like, you know, he says, well, there is no God, but we do have these super amazing aliens that are very godlike, you know? So here, you know, Douglas Adams is like, you know, we as Catholics, you know, we read things like Job, you know, where God says, where were you when I started the earth? You know, you're asking me these questions. Where were you? And Douglas Adams basically does the same thing, but the universe itself is the thing that's turning him away, right? You know, he's saying you don't even ask, you don't even know what question you're asking.
Nice connection with Job.
Well, thanks.
Sweet. Yeah. No, really, this works totally that way.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Douglas Adams might not like to hear that, but, you know.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, we do this show, you know, and this is how things strike us, you know, with our Catholic lenses on. We are certainly not claiming that Douglas Adams especially was writing with these things in mind, but it's still it's how it strikes us, or strikes me.
Well, but that's the thing about art, right? You put it out there, and then what people get from it, hopefully they're not reading too much into it, which is always what we're keeping an eye on, hopefully.
Right.
But you can't help how it hits you.
Nope, you can't.
The art is there to be used. And I like that idea of it being like Job, which I never really actually would have thought of as an absurdist piece of work. But the Bible's got everything in it. And it actually kind of works that way, because the friends in Job always struck me as being extremely sensible. Everything they said were things I understood.
Hmm.
Job's the one who kept going, nope, you're wrong. It doesn't apply to me. And I still want my answer.
Right.
And that's what Douglas Adams is doing. Oh, no, all those answers you guys thought of, you're wrong. You didn't know that the dolphins were smarter than you. You didn't know they're trying to give you a hint.
So long, and thanks for all the fish.
Yeah.
I love that line.
Yeah.
That's great stuff. And then you have things like Arthur Dent. Arthur Dent, who is the fish out of water, right? He has no idea what he's doing ever. And they're over this Magrathea, and missiles are headed their way. And he's the one who accidentally figures out how to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I love stories like that, where all the experts, quote unquote, are trying to figure out what to do. And it's the non-expert that can see something differently that has the answer.
Right.
And in this case, Arthur, you know, he did it by accident.
Right.
What happens if I press, shouldn't I press the, yeah, and he presses it. And then the next thing that happens after that, it's brilliant. It's so funny. So tragic. So funny.
It's
a bowl of petunias and a whale appear in place of those missiles because of the improbability drive. And that speech that whale gives, if you haven't heard that on the audio drama, I got to get it to you.
I heard Stephen Fry.
Yeah, Stephen Fry is terrific too. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not the same, I know.
Oh, that reminds me. I did find my Douglas Adams narrated Hitchhiker's Guide. It was in my Audible queue.
Oh.
So I don't know if Audible still sells it, but
no, they don't.
Way back when I bought it, and it's still in my library there.
No, they don't sell it anymore.
That's where I have it. So
everybody's mad about that.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why they'd redo it, but the Audible version has kind of a low audio quality on that audiobook. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that was something that they just couldn't fix and then they just decided to re-record it. But Stephen Fry is brilliant, and I did listen to most of his version as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he's fantastic.
He is so good.
Yeah. Just great.
And I would say one thing about this, which is kind of a little off topic for the where we were going, but one of the things that makes it work, whether or not you think he's mean-spirited, whether or not you care that he's like making little jabs, because it's not the overall point of the book,
mm-hmm.
Is for me, he's kind of like Raymond Chandler, where you just go, well, the plot's okay, and it might not really hang together, but the writing is so fantastic, you just don't care. You're there for, you know, for Chandler, you're there for all the great expressions and the wonderful way things are said or the emotions that are being told, and there's a plot. And in this, you're there for the humor.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just so laugh out loud funny, and you're reading pieces of it to other people.
Right. Yeah, endlessly quotable, just like, you know, Monty Python.
Yeah, exactly. And the way he is so good at flipping things on their head, because that's one of my favorite things that everybody's tired of having me read to them is, you know, before they get picked up by the ship off of Earth, Ford Prefect is telling Arthur, you better drink a lot because, you know, it's not going to be so bad if you're drunk. Or, you know, it's, what is it? I can't remember the first sentence of it where he's like, it's like being drunk. And Arthur says, what's so bad about being drunk? Ford says, ask a glass of water.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I like that. Fantastic.
And he kind of does that in this. He's doing that with the ideas that he comes up with or the little comments he makes, as much as with just, you know, being funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree. And I'm thrilled that it's absurd to Douglas Adams to have a computer come up with the meaning of life. You know,
yes, I hadn't
because
thought of that.
I know that there's a lot of people who believe that, you know, in some way that that's really where the answer is, you know, is, you know, if we can just get a big enough computer, you know, all of our problems will be solved. And that scene where they're asking the computer, you know, the computer's called Deep Thought, and they're asking the computer the question at the beginning is just fantastic. And then you have the absurdity of the philosophers that come in, which I absolutely love that too.
Yeah.
And so they build this big computer, Deep Thought, and they're asking it the question of life, the universe, and everything. You know, and then it says, a sudden commotion destroyed the moment. A door flew open and two angry men wearing the coarse faded blue robes and belt of the Creswin University burst into the room, thrusting aside the ineffectual flunky who tried to bar their way. We demand admission, shouted the younger of the two men, elbowing a pretty young secretary in the throat. Come on, shouted the older one. You can't keep us out. He pushed a junior programmer back through the door. We demand that you can't keep us out, bawled the younger one. Though he was now firmly inside the room, and no further attempts were made to stop him. Who are you? Said Lunkwill, rising angrily from his seat. What do you want? I am Magic Thighs, announced the older one. And I demand that I am Vroomfondle, shouted the younger one. Magic Thighs turned on Vroomfondle. It's all right, he explained angrily. You don't need to demand that. All right, bawled Vroomfondle, banging on the nearby desk. I am Vroomfondle, and that is not a demand. That is a solid fact. What we demand are solid facts. No, we don't, exclaimed Magic Thighs in irritation. That is precisely what we don't demand. Scarcely pausing for a breath, Vroomfondle shouted, we don't demand solid facts. What we demand is a total absence of solid facts. I demand that I may or may not be Vroomfondle. Anyway, it goes on from there. But I just love that. I just love it. It's like, you know, you have this absurdist, you know, computer, the absurdity of asking that computer, you know, I keep saying that, but I just love that. But then you have this down-to-earth thing that's happening. Well, how is that going to affect the philosophers? And
right.
That stops so much progress in our world where we're like, you know, we need to do this as a society. Well, we can't do that because what will that do to the oil workers or right. What will that do to this industry or that industry? And we end up doing nothing, right?
Right, exactly. It's
like, yeah, we're, you know, so on one hand, you know, we're not going to ask what the ultimate question of the universe is or what the answer is. We can't have that because what will that do to the philosophers?
Well, and it's... And I feel like we're seeing that kind of behavior now. Again, I was reading this thinking, this is really prescient with people going on marches for everything now.
Oh, yeah.
I'm marching for science. And I'm like, is science a thing that I don't understand what's going on anymore.
I don't understand that either.
Yeah, I'm just like, I don't think we're anti-science, are we? If I'm not marching, I'm still for science. I didn't know who wasn't for science. It was very confusing to me. It was just a progression of
like,
all these marches.
Can I be part of this march, or am I? Or what is the point here exactly?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I was talking to somebody who was involved in a couple of the marches, like the Women's March or something. And I was saying something about, well, because you were against something to do with President Trump, and I can't remember what it was. She said, no, we weren't against anything. We were pro. And I said, oh, pro what? Well, pro woman. And I'm like, and what about the women? Well, just, you know, pro woman. That was as much as she could come up with.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, I feel like there should have been a point to it, like equal yeah. pay or more opportunity. I don't know. But I was like, oh my gosh, this book. I was like, it was just like talking to that person.
Yeah. Yeah. That is something. It's happening a lot today. A lot of redefining things, you know, but, you know, so
I'm not thinking about them.
Yeah. But if you can successfully say that being pro-woman equals this set of things.
Mm-hmm.
And now once you succeed in that, then any deviation is anti-woman.
Right.
And that's what they're after, right?
And not tolerant and a hater and all various. I mean, all these labels suddenly get put on stuff. And that scene that you read is just perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. I may or may not be broom fondle. You know, and then that one. So one guy is like, you know, I know what I'm talking about. And the other guy has absolutely no idea, just following.
Right.
You know, trying to keep up. No real convictions of his own.
But I want to be very important about it.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I also, and this again is a very minor point, I really liked the things that he was prescient about, like ebooks, touch screens, just things like, and then he would, of course, take them and push them a little nudge. And so you had the idea of, wasn't it the music in the spaceship that, you know, you started off being able to tell it what you wanted to hear. And then pretty soon you just had to wave a finger in its direction and it would know what you wanted to hear. Of course, then the problem was you had to sit absolutely still because any gesture would change the channel, you know.
Yeah.
And it made me think Yeah, exactly. And so, and I'm like, we're kind of in that progression because this morning I was just reading a piece about all the tech stuff that's in cars and how many people are just struggling to turn it off.
Oh, that's so funny because I saw that it was in the Wall Street Journal, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
Yeah, my car won't stop beeping, I think is what the article was called.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah, you're right.
Or, you know, all the voice stuff where it's going, I can't recognize. Was it? It wasn't Tom Petty. It was Elton John. Play Elton John, and it never will play Elton John. It plays one of two other bands, and it made me think of being on the Heart of Gold or one of these other spaceships where nothing's working exactly like it. You think it will work?
It should, right? And then you have things like Star Wars, where in the the technology works so well in Star Wars that it really isn't a thing. Star Wars is fantasy, but all the stuff always just works. You know, the however intricate the machine is, those things operate. And it just kind of fades into the background as, you know, technology is just part of life. Mm-hmm. But I call what you're saying, you know, it's the electric belt stuff. Because back when electricity was first invented or first discovered, right, people were making electric everything. And though it was absolutely not needed at all, you know, it's of absolutely no help to have a electrical way to buckle your belt. And that was being sold back
was
then.
Was there an electric belt?
An electric belt, yep.
Oh,
so somehow it would snap shut or something.
This.
Yeah. So you can look that up. But we are going through that, you know, in technology, you know, as people come up with things, you know, they're trying things, various things. But there ought to be, you know, something where you say, is this helping me or is it not helping me? And if it's not, you know, we probably ought not be doing it.
Right.
I was talking to a farmer the other day and he was lamenting how, you know, he can't fix his truck anymore.
Yeah.
And how, you know, I was thinking, you know, if Ford or somebody could come out with a throwback pickup that doesn't have any electronics on it, I think it would sell like crazy. I don't know if it's even possible for them to do that because of all the emission standards and everything. But if you could just remove all the computers and all that stuff so that a person could use their knowledge to get the thing running and limp home if it was broken, like they used to be able to, but now you can't.
Well, and my brother loves to work on cars. This is something he discovered after he became an adult. Mm. And he's been having to work on older and older cars. Because you can't do that with the new cars. Mm. What a shame, you know?
Yeah, it is a shame. Yeah, now you hook up a computer to it and you say, mm-hmm. and usually what it says is, oh, you need to replace this chip or something like that. Right. And you're like, well, that's not something I can do.
Yeah,
and somehow it's shut down all operation because some programmer either made an error or they decided that if you don't have this, then that, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I know something else he was prescient about is electronics having personality.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Because so true.
Yeah. Now we have Alexa and Siri and they're bright and cheerful. We don't have Marvin the depressed robot yet.
I'm so depressed. Here I am, brain the size of a planet.
And they have the doors on the spaceship. Yep. The brochure says, all the doors in this spaceship have a cheerful and sunny disposition. It is their pleasure to open for you and their satisfaction to close again with the knowledge of a job well done. As the door closed behind them, it became apparent that it did indeed have a satisfied sigh-like quality to it. It said. And I just love that. Everybody hates the doors. They're too cheerful. I thought, oh yeah, this whole thing of giving it names and having a voice of
Siri,
you know,
Cortana,
right?
Yep.
All that.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Yeah. Yeah. And he was prescient about that. And yeah, it's going to get nothing but more and more of that.
Do you
have an iPhone?
I have a smartphone.
Okay.
I have it's a Motorola.
I was curious because you can ask Siri questions like tell me a joke. You know, and things like that, and she will.
I understand that can happen. I myself am so contrary.
Uh-huh.
I use my smartphone for phone calls, which is nuts. Texting.
Mm-hmm.
Only to a few approved people.
Uh-huh.
And that's it. If I'm out of town, like when my mom was sick a few years ago and I was in the hospital, I was using the Google function in order to look up stuff as we talked about movies, but that was it. I was like, nope, I'm just going to use it as a phone.
Yep.
I'm just backwards. So I don't have Alexa.
And there again, why not, you know, is somebody taking advantage of the people that desire that in the market, giving you a very cheap phone that just does that, you know, just texts and phone calls, and that's all I want.
Well, actually, I will stop for a moment to plug Republic Wireless, which basically is very inexpensive. I mean, it's still the Motorola Android phone, but they have it specially done for them. And you can do all the stuff on it. You can have maps and everything and all the apps you want. But they have you buy the phone up front, so it's not a big, expensive plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have a plan that is as little as, I think, $15 or $20 a month. And then you can add on data or whatever if you want to. But they refund at the end of every month what you didn't use. So mine is a $25 plan, and every month I get back $15.
Nice.
Yeah, because I just don't use it for all that other stuff. I'm not streaming things and all that. So just FYI, everybody.
That
but what
sounds
I'd really
great to
like,
me.
Like you say, I'd really like the old school small flip phone with texting made easy. That's all I want.
You and I are similar because I went with a pager for a long time.
Oh, okay.
I didn't even have the flip phone. It's because, you know, I don't want to be answering the phone all day. So I just had a pager well into the flip phone era. I still carried a pager. It's like, it'd beep and then I would get to them when I could.
Yeah.
And now we have this constant interruption machine.
Well, because when I go out, the phone I have is our home phone. And when I go out of the house, I turn on airplane mode because I don't want to be bothered by anything when I'm out. I just have it in case I have an emergency.
I love it. That's good.
I never have to use it. And I come back and I turn it on and see if I have any messages, because I'm just like, I don't want all that stuff bugging me.
Yeah. That's good.
So I do everything I can to turn it off.
You bet.
Well, Rose, our youngest daughter, just gave up her flip phone maybe a year ago.
Hmm.
She had trouble texting with it, but she was doing her best. She was just like, I don't like those big phones. They won't fit in my pocket. And so.
Yeah, and they're getting larger.
Oh, my gosh.
They were getting smaller, and now they're getting larger.
Yes, I like the small ones.
Yeah. And they will have genuine people personalities, right?
Yeah. Mine might. I have no idea. I won't let it say anything to me.
Oh, now I have a vision of this thing, poor thing, trying to get out. It has so much to say.
And I'm so unfriendly to it. It's like Marvin. It's now very depressed.
Shoot. That's funny. I was listening to a podcast just the other day about robots and how humans give them personalities in their head.
If you have
a robot, or even if it doesn't talk or anything like that, the moment, you know, and I work with those during the day, you know, and at the school I teach in, and you have like an industrial robot arm, and there's just something about the movement that makes people want to name it, right? And once you've named it, then, you know, some people name their cars, and
there's just something
about that. Yeah,
I can see naming the robot.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
But the minute you said cars, I suddenly backed away from the whole idea. I went, nope, never named my car. Don't care about them that much.
Yep. I don't think I've ever named a car either. But robots are becoming ubiquitous, right? They're more and more and more. And, you know, it shows some type of lifelike motion, and people want to name it.
Yeah, we latch on to that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a human quality. We want to name things. That's like Adam in Genesis.
Yeah.
Where he was told, here's everything, name it.
Good point.
Ooh, excellent.
Mm-hmm. I like it.
Yeah.
Yep, and a whale that's falling through the sky.
Oh, stop.
Just wants to name the wind.
No.
And I like it that, you know, near the end, he says, have I made a coherent picture of everything yet?
Oh,
no.
Yeah.
It's like he's having such deep thoughts for such a short little existence.
No. He's living his life as fully as he can and as quickly. Oh,
poor whale.
Oh, my gosh.
I love it.
Make me think of, I was listening to Ender's Game, the first episode, and we've kind of exchanged a couple emails about that, because I've finally gone, okay, I'm going to read Ender's Game, but I'm going to do it with Mythgard Academy.
Cool.
And which is, it's so far a very good book. But anyway, and Corey Olson suddenly stops and goes off on this, which I love when he does this. He goes off on the whole idea of characters in books are just characters in books. They should be put there to move the story along. So when you're looking at them, they're not people. And, you know, of course, you can feel moved by them or sad or whatever. He goes, but the reason they're there should be to serve the story.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, so let's look at everything Ender's doing, and whatever particular thing was coming up that was making him suddenly stop. And he said, you know, these days people tend to talk about, you know, oh, the character just took over and wrote the, you know, he goes, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, but I'm here for the story.
Yeah.
And maybe that was part of me reading this and going, maybe when I was going, he seems kind of mean and angry, although he's quite funny, is I was like, where's the big story? And there's not a lot of big story in it. And so when you bring up the whale, to me, he's a character. He's real. I'm going to cry over him. I'm doing what Corey Olson said I should not do.
I love it. That is funny.
He was never real. Stop. That's funny. Getting upset about him.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, the meanness that you're talking about, and I wonder, you know, there are people like what is his name, Oscar Wilde, Voltaire, right?
Oh, yeah,
those guys were mean,
yeah.
Right? And then there's just this quality. But I'm trying to think, you know, is there a contemporary? You know, you have people like Don Rickles, who I don't find very funny.
No, never.
But he's, you know, just kind of mean.
Yep. And Douglas Adams, I don't put in that spot. I guess if I was going to be asked, I don't know. There was some vibe coming off of it.
Maybe it
was angry. Maybe mm-hmm. it was just that he was being pointed and I noticed it for the first time. Because honestly, when I read it, it was so long ago and I read it two or three times, but it would have been way before I ever became Christian.
Mm, yeah.
You know, so I wouldn't have noticed it, or I would have gone along with it if I'd have thought about it, maybe.
Sure.
But I wasn't thinking about it. I didn't read then the way I read now. Now I pay more attention to stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe I was paying too much attention.
No, I don't think so.
But he was continually poking that button.
Yes.
Not in me, but I mean just that button of, here's the point again. Here it is again. Here it is again. And I'd never noticed that as a theme. Hmm. So I could be...
Very interesting. Yeah.
Misinterpreting.
You're not misinterpreting at all. Huh. That's how it hits you, right? That's what we talked about a little bit earlier. Yeah.
You could still... Oh, one other thing I wanted to say about Douglas Adams. So this also kind of helped explain a lot about him to me, along with the Monty Python kind of thing, is he was a huge fan of P.G. Wodehouse. Well, I always said Wodehouse for a long time. And that to me explained a lot, because in many ways, this is a comedy of manners that is just totally throwing Arthur off balance always, because he doesn't know what the manners are, you know, what the norms are around him. And what P.G. Wodehouse would do is he would escalate and escalate and escalate and escalate until finally you're just laughing so hard over the absurdity of it all and how it's brought together in these intricately plotted comedies of manners that are nothing else. There's never a big story there. I mean, well, the big story is Bertie going to have to marry this girl that he suddenly decided he's not suited for at all? Can he get out of it? And is he going to be accused of stealing the silver cow creamer that he never really stole? You know, he doesn't have the bread. Those are the plots. They're wonderful and very much like this in those ways.
Nice. Where would one start with a P.G. Wodehouse?
One of the Jeeves and Bertie and Jeeves books. I don't know which one. You can start anywhere, because they do occasionally refer to other books, but it doesn't really ever matter.
Okay.
They'll say, oh, my cousin Roderick, who you may recall him from the silver cow creamer incident in Gloucester. And then they'll go, but he was now in love with so-and-so, Dahlia so-and-so or whatever. I'll try and find some names that we can.
Okay.
But they're just so funny.
Sounds good.
In a very different way.
Cool. Well, all right. Well, thank you for talking about this book.
Oh, thank you for picking it.
That was fun.
I read it.
That was fun. And we talked longer than I thought we would about it, because at the beginning of the podcast, I said, this may be very short.
Yes.
All of a sudden, it's an hour later.
Somehow we never managed to talk short. Don't know how that is.
I don't know either. Shoot,
people
that's
may
great.
Get tired of listening.
You bet.
But we're still talking.
You bet. So next up is Inherit the Wind movie.
Yes.
And I'm excited to talk about that. Speaking of March for Science, this will get them riled up, right?
So.
But yeah, I'm looking forward to talking about it. It's a terrific movie. Very well done.
Yeah, and I've heard so much about it, and I've never seen it. So this is great. I'm really looking forward to it. And I would also like to mention, for anybody who keeps up with us, and some people actually do, it's so pleasing to see when somebody's going, oh, I'm reading this because it's coming up on your podcast. It's so nice.
That's really cool.
But we're going to read in a month, we're going to talk about A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. It is not his longest, but being Dickens, it is long. So
I've got my copy right here. It's about 480 pages is what I've got.
Okay.
Yay.
Yeah. So for Dickens, that's about half length.
Yep. I love it. I may start that later today.
Me too. And I have the Naxos audiobook of it, which is amazing. So just FYI.
Cool. Wonderful.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again. Thanks for listening, everybody.
So long, and thanks for all the fish.
I love it. We'll see you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.